What would you do if your house burned down, killing your entire family in one night? Bill Clegg will talk about his debut novel, Did You Ever Have a Family?
So you arrive at these characters sort of at their lowest point, and as they sort of step out from that grief and carry a fair bit of regret and guilt for the events that had taken place.
How is it possible to survive in America on zero income? Catherine Eden joins us to talk about $2 a day, living on almost nothing in America.
So we tell one story of Jennifer Hernandez, who's working cleaning foreclosed homes that have no power or heat and in the middle of the Chicago winter, and kneeling in the dark, scrubbing with broken glass and these homes that are just infested with mold.
Alexander Alter will fill us in on the latest from the literary world. Greg Coles has bestseller news, and we'll let listeners and readers weigh in with a few questions for us editors here at the Book Review. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Bill Clegg joins us now from London. He is the author of Did You Ever Have a Family, which is reviewed this week with a glowing review from Kuei Hart Hemmings, the author of The Descendants and the Possibilities, among other books. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Pamela. How are you?
I'm good. So are you in London related to your book recently being named on the long list of the Man Booker Prize?
Well, I was always supposed to be here for the release of the book, which is this week. And I started at the Edinburgh Book Festival, where I did a reading and a Q&A with an author named Andrew Miller, who has written a great book called The Crossing. And a couple of clients of mine were there, too. So it was kind of great to see old friends and hang out in Edinburgh for a little bit.
But I imagine your book is getting a lot more attention than it might otherwise have gotten had it not been named on the, I guess this is the second year now that Americans are eligible for the Man Booker Prize.
Yeah, it seems to be louder here than it is in the States. Yeah, I'm grateful. It's funny to see a prize that seems to generate so much conversation here. I hope it's the same with other prizes in the States, just because it's good that people are talking about books.
Well, you're very used to talking about books because you've been an agent for a long time. You've written two memoirs. This is your first novel. How is this experience different from your other work in the publishing industry, now being on the novelist side?
Well, it's much more fun to talk about made-up people than it is to talk about yourself. So start with that. At first, I thought I wouldn't have that much to say about the novel, which sounds weird because I talk about novels a lot for my job. Even when I sort of met some booksellers early on in this process, I said to the publisher, I was like, I don't really have much to say, you know. I mean, and part of that, I guess, was because I had, you know, published two memoirs, and that's how I knew to talk about a book that I had written, which the road steers back to me. With the novel, when I had met these booksellers who had read the book, and they were really the first people outside of my family and friends and the book editor and publisher who had read it. It was this kind of funny reunion with people that nobody else knew but them. You know, it's like this closed set of characters who had been in my head for 7 years and I'd talked about with family and friends. But these people knew them, had read the book, and so it was kind of like gossiping about people we knew that nobody else did. And so it was kind of fun on that level. And I've actually enjoyed it. I finished the book a year ago, so talking about it now is kind of like resurrecting these characters who just haven't been in my life for a little while.
All right, well, tell us about these characters so that we can now gossip about them.
You arrive at them at the beginning of the book pretty much at their lowest point. A house is blown up from an explosion from a propane leak, and four people die, and you meet all the people who were connected to their lives in short order as the book opens. And so you arrive at these characters sort of at their lowest point, and as they sort of step out from that grief and carry a fair bit of regret and guilt for the events that had taken place, and as the book sort of unfolds, you get to find out more about sort of exactly what happened and what led to the explosion. The exact specifics of that are kind of less important than kind of how these people suffer through their grief alone and then very slowly find their way to connect with other people.
Would you describe it as a book about grief?
I would say it's about grief, yes. But one of the sort of North Stars of the book for me was forgiveness and kind of the importance of that in families, but also in the relationships that we have outside of our families and with friends and spouses, and how I've experienced that in my own life. Certainly the importance of being forgiven, but also like learning how to forgive other people, which is, you know, not an easy process, and especially for those that we're closest to and who have oftentimes hurt us the most.
Reading about the premise of the story, it takes place in a small Connecticut town. The person who survives is the mother, June Reed. I was reminded of a recent real event. There was a house that burned down in Connecticut with a doctor, I think, who is the father. Did you get the idea from that news story?
No, I mean, sadly, there are so many stories of families sort of losing parents and children in sudden tragedies. They're just, I feel like you could open up the paper and see something that you almost wouldn't believe in fiction happen almost every day. Originally, the book was born out of wanting to write about the place that I'm from. I'm from a small town in Litchfield County. And when I was writing the first memoir, it had been the first time that I had gone back into actively remembering those years and that place and the time that I spent there. I'd spent most of my 20s and certainly all of my college years actively forgetting where I was from. And so in my early 30s, when I was in recovery and then when I was writing the memoir, going back into that those spaces and into that time was part of that process. And I looked at that town with new eyes and the experience there, and became interested in it separate from my own experience. And so the first three words of the book for a long time were "She will go," and I wrote those 7 years ago, and I didn't know who she was or where she was going, but I knew she was leaving a place like the one that I had been born into. And the sort of the why of it kind of emerged later through the voices of the characters in the book. So I knew a little bit about the main character, June, but I found out more about her. I sort of imagined this town that this woman is leaving and how she would be the cause of a story. You know, anybody coming and going, anything dramatic happening in this small town is cause for chatter. And certainly it was in the town that I grew up in. So I wrote out a lot of these voices to kind of tell the story. Many of those voices didn't end up in the book, but it sort of filled in the blanks of like what had caused her leaving. And so it really sort of came from that.
In your acknowledgments, you mention you thank someone for singling out the six words that planted the seed all those years ago. Are those the six words of the title?
Yes, they're the six words of the title. It was Haven Kimmel, who I worked with back then, and she had a brilliant novel called Something Rising, Light and Swift, and she had chosen those six words as the epigraph for the novel and sent me the poem when she did, and I was gobsmacked. I thought she should use that as the title for her book at the time. And then when I started writing the book, that title, like those words, you know, really sort of came front and center and, you know, acted as, you know, a real kind of guiding light through the process. In the poem, it has a question mark. In the title of the book, there's no question mark, because to me, that question is more of a statement. It seems like the answer to a question, an explanation for a kind of exhaustion and gratitude, like family as burden, but also as, you know, miracle. And really, the title was an important part of the writing. Whenever I would sort of go off course or kind of lose direction, I did think back on that those words a lot, and oftentimes it guided me.
Your day job is as an agent, as we mentioned earlier. Who are some of the writers you represent?
Oh, dear.
I know, you're afraid you're going to leave out names, but just a few of them.
Well, I'll talk about people who are publishing books right now. Lauren Groff, whose novel Fates and Furies is coming out next week, and is certainly, I think, the best thing she's ever written. And that's saying something, the books that she's written before.
You're slipping into your other job here.
I know. I can't help it. It's much more comfortable than talking about my own. But it's an amazing book. Otessa Moshfegh, who has a novel called Eileen, which has just published. And
we reviewed on our cover.
Yes, and we were very happy to see that. And just, it's an extraordinary book. And she's an important young writer. And her stories are also incredible, if anybody is interested. So those are two who are publishing right now. And David Levithan, also, who has a novel called Another Day that's coming out right now.
It's a young adult novel?
Exactly, yes.
Is it odd to be in the same position alongside your clients?
It is. I'm far more comfortable being behind the curtain and talking about their books.
But were you always someone who knew all along, one of the many people in publishing who always wanted to be a novelist, or is this something that came lately to you?
You know, I think somebody asked this question to me some time ago, and when I was answering it, I thought of my sexuality, oddly, which is that I didn't really know I was gay until I was, didn't name it out loud until I was in my early 20s and living in New York. I grew up in a small town in Connecticut. I went to college in a small town in Maryland. And I didn't have any access. It was before social media. And I didn't have access to a gay culture or world. And even though I had a sense that there was something sort of different about me, I didn't really reckon with it until I came here where it was possible. And I think with fiction, you know, it's just been so important to me. It was, you know, kind of my savior as a kid and just a place I've retreated into my whole life, and it's become my job, and I can't believe I get paid to do what I do. So it was sort of so important that I almost couldn't name that desire, but of course it was there the whole time. I really couldn't name that desire until I had written two memoirs and sort of gone through whatever I went through and got to where I am. And then it bubbled up as with those three words, She Will Go, and then it sort of began before I even could kind of recognize that that's what I was doing, was writing a novel. And so I kind of had to back into it for it to happen and have the confidence to go forward with it.
Now you are a fully realized multi-hyphenate agent, memoirist, novelist. So congratulations.
Thank you very much.
The book again is Did You Ever Have a Family by Bill Clegg. Bill, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Alexander Alter joins us now with notes from the publishing world. Hi, Alexander.
Hi, Pamela.
So we've got good news and bad news. Let's start with the bad news, so then we could cheer up.
That's a good idea. So publishers were sort of whiplashed in recent months with erratic sales, and the latest report from the Association of American Publishers was sort of grim. It showed sharp declines for the month of May, which is the most recent month tracked, and some surprising categories. So adult books were down by 5% compared to the same month last year, and young adult and children's also fell by 9%.
That never happens.
Surprising. Yeah, it's been such a strong area in the last few years with really amazing blockbuster sales by John Green and Veronica Roth and Suzanne Collins. And so I think probably a lot of people are freaking out about this change. Although, of course, there could be another movie adaptation and things could bounce back.
There needs to be a new phenomenon.
Exactly. You know, in different categories, we saw hardcover sales fell by 17%, which is quite a lot. Mass market paperback fell by 40%. That category has been struggling for a while. Ebook sales were also down. But digital audio is still huge, surging. It went up 62% in May compared to the previous year, which is kind of remarkable.
All right. Well, all those bad numbers will quickly change when the new fall books come out.
That's right. There's a flood of fiction coming out in the fall. This is sort of to publishing what the Oscar season is to the film industry. So we have some really big names in all categories. There's, you know, we're going to have new books by Michael Connelly, Lee Child, John Grisham. Stephen King has a short story collection coming out. And then, of course, there's all the big literary fiction. Salman Rushdie's new novel is coming out next week, which is quite fun. It's sort of this wild fantasy tale. It's a riff on Scheherazade, and there's genies and magic and all kinds of wild.
What's the name of that book?
That's 2 years, 8 months, and 28 nights, which is a riff on 1,001 nights, if you do the math.
You've checked his math? Has it been fact-checked, Alexandra?
No, I did fact-check it. I took him at his word. And a few weeks from now, we're going to have a new Margaret Atwood novel, which is dark and funny like a lot of her work. It's a dystopian book that she first published on Byliner and then developed into a full novel. And beyond that, we have Umberto Eco, Mary Gateskill, Isabel Allende, John Irving, and a lot of interesting nonfiction coming out, too. Stacey Schiff's book about the Salem witch trials is coming out. It's called The Witches. It was excerpted in The New Yorker. And Mary Carr has a book coming out on the art of memoir. Elizabeth Gilbert has a book on creativity. So I think with all these big names and all these big titles, there should be a shift in sales.
I'll hold you to that. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks, Pamela.
Catherine Eden joins us now. She is a professor of sociology and public health at Johns Hopkins and co-author with Luke Schaefer of a new book, $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America, reviewed this week in the Book Review by William Julius Wilson. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. So this is a subject you have researched for a long time, but looking specifically at single mothers. Is this also looking at that same group, or who are these people who are living in such extreme poverty?
It's true that I did spend most of my career studying single mothers and so-called absent fathers, and this is really not that group. Interestingly enough, $2 a day poverty, which really hasn't been around historically, but is sort of a new phenomenon, a relatively new phenomenon, is kind of an equal opportunity condition. So we see that a third of couples, for example, or a third of households in $2 a day poverty are actually married couple households. We see about an equal representation of whites along with African Americans and Latinos. We see $2 a day poverty in rural areas, maybe particularly in the Deep South and Appalachia, as well as in our cities. So its diversity is one of its chief characteristics of this condition.
When you talk about extreme poverty, how is that defined, and how did you come up with the $2 figure?
I was doing field work here in Baltimore in 2010. I'd been studying the working poor. I spent the early part of my career prior to welfare reform, actually, studying the welfare poor and their income-generating strategies. But I'd kind of left that behind, and I began studying the working poor. And when I came back into the field to study people who were not necessarily employed, I was stunned by the number of households that I came across that had no source of cash income. So in the book, we tell the story of Ashley here in Baltimore, who's visibly depressed. She has trouble supporting her baby's head. There's no formula in the house. And it was experiences like that that drove us to the numbers, that drove Luke and I to look at the best government data available to see if there were a group of Americans since welfare reform had essentially eliminated, or we say in the book, welfare is dead. So few people are getting welfare in the United States now as compared to what was true prior to welfare reform. So was there sort of this new hidden kind of poverty that had emerged in the aftermath of welfare reform? And the numbers said yes. And in fact, if you look over the course of a year, you know, 3.4 million kids are living below this threshold for at least 3 months. So even if you eliminate the short spells, this is a big group. This is as many kids as we rescue from poverty through our cash, tax, and transfer programs. So we ended up using the rubric $2 a day because it's a number the World Bank uses to assess global poverty. And it's never been applied in the U.S. before, to our knowledge. And I think it gives us a useful way of thinking about how America is both similar to and different from the developing world.
How many people are we talking about, and what percentage of the population overall falls into this category?
It's about one out of every 25 households, and that means it's about one in four poor households at any given time. So, you know, when you're walking down the street in your daily life, you're likely to have passed by at some point during your day someone who is or has recently been in this condition.
I think it's important to define these terms like poverty and extreme poverty, because I think people aren't necessarily aware of the figures attached to them. When you say the threshold for poverty, for example, or below poverty, how do we define poverty in this country?
Well, in this country, we use in Europe, we usually use a relative standard for poverty. It's some percentage of median income. Here in the United States, we have more of an absolute measure. It was developed in the 60s, and it's been based on how people spent money on food, actually. It's kind of got a crazy history. But what we find is that number just gets updated every year for inflation, and it ceased to have any real meaning since it's now so low and so sort of out of touch with American expenditure.
So it really understates the number of poor, that official figure. What is the current household income that's used to define poverty?
Well, poverty, so extreme poverty is, you know, is this $2 a day threshold.
Right.
So, but poverty in general for a family of four, I don't know the exact figure, but it's somewhere in the low 20s. So you can imagine that, you know, earning a poverty wage wouldn't even cover your rent in most places in America. The New York Times has actually done some amazing reporting on that very issue.
Why has this group been overlooked from official data? I mean, there's been so much talk recently about income inequality. Has this group been entirely left out of that discussion?
You know, it really has. What's striking about this group is that this is a group of workers. This is not a group of dependents. If you look at the best data that we have available, what we see is only 10% of the $2 a day poor are even claiming a penny from TANF over the course of a year. And this is amazing. But 70% have an adult in the labor market. TANF is what we now is America's main cash welfare program. It sort of took over from AFDC, Aid for Families with Dependent Children, our old welfare system, in 1996. It means temporary assistance to needy families, and it is time-limited, and it is no longer an entitlement. So states are not required to make sure you get it just because you've established need.
This is the product of President Clinton's welfare reform.
Yes, President Clinton and the Republican Congress,
right. Okay.
And what we really see here is that this is the group that's hanging on to the ragged tail of the worst of the bad jobs that are out there. And one thing we have seen since welfare was reformed is that the bad jobs in the American economy have gotten a lot worse. You know, we have gone from bad to worse in terms of the quality of the jobs. You can't find full-time work at the bottom of the economy. You can't take two jobs because each employer requires, you know, infinite flexibility. You're not going to get stable hours, so it's very difficult to plan your budget. Anytime the foot traffic slows, you're going to get sent home. You might be asked to sign a zero-hour full-time zero-hour contract where you're not guaranteed any hours, although you're required to keep your availability open for the full amount of time that you've agreed to. We find wage theft is rampant. One common practice is that employers in hotels will ask maids to clean a room before they clock in, for example. Employers will ask people to work 60 hours without giving them any overtime. The physical demands of many of these jobs at the very bottom of the economy for anyone with any sort of health condition can be really brutal. So we tell one story of Jennifer Hernandez, who's working cleaning foreclosed homes that have no power or heat in the middle of a Chicago winter, and kneeling in the dark, scrubbing with broken glass and these homes that are just infested with mold.
How does this woman you've described cleaning these houses, how does she live? Where does she live?
She has been living in a string of homeless shelters looking for work. She's been pounding the pavement. She doesn't have any minutes on her cell phone, so when an employer calls back, she's got to work through the shelter and, you know, a sort of a note system, a notice left on her door, and, you know, making it very, you know, very hard for employers to actually reach her. But she finally gets this job at Chicago City Custodial Services. At that point, she qualifies for a special program from the shelter that gives her a housing subsidy for 1 year, at which time she is supposed to have achieved self-sufficiency through work. Now, of course, this is not going to happen, right? This job at Chicago City, you know, is a relatively well-paying job. She can earn up to $9 an hour, but the hours are not guaranteed. The work conditions are brutal. As the clock is ticking, she's just realizing she's not going to be able to sort of pay the rent on the apartment by herself when the year elapses. A lot of programs sort of assume that people can achieve self-sufficiency relatively quickly, and they'll penalize you by evicting you and taking away your subsidy if you don't make it. You know, their intentions are good. They want to help as many people as they can, and they don't want to encourage dependency. But, given changes in the labor market, it's very difficult, if not impossible, in a high-rent city like Chicago for a family with a low-wage worker heading it to be able to achieve self-sufficiency.
How did these people get into the situations they're in to begin with? Were they born into this kind of poverty? Is it circumstantial?
So there's a real mix. Some folks have very, very difficult circumstances stemming from childhood. Ray McCormick, for example, from Cleveland, Ohio, you know, she is abandoned by her mother after her father dies. Her mother runs off, actually, to Appalachia with a lover and leaves a 12-year-old alone to fend for herself with only her father's Social Security death benefits to live on. By the time, you know, Ray is in her late teens, all of her teeth have fallen out because of a lack of dental care. Very tough circumstances in a childhood trauma that keeps swamping her just in a sea of poverty. Currently, Ray is on 12 different medications a day for various, you know, health problems, probably stemming from this amazing traumatic childhood, and things in her adult life have continued to traumatize her. So that's sort of one type. Another type is Paul Heckwilder, also from Cleveland. He was a relatively middle-class guy. He and his children owned a chain of pizza restaurants. When a family business hits the recession and goes under, the whole family suffers, and there's really no network resources to draw on. So at one point in time, Paul had 24 people living in his house with only his Social Security check to support them all, putting them all under $2 per person per day. So we really see, people in this category sort of coming from many walks of life. Many of them do, by the way, have health challenges, but that's both a cause and a consequence,
right,
of living at this threshold.
There's a startling statistic in the book that since the passage of welfare reform in 1996, the number of families living in $2-a-day poverty has more than doubled, and that's just of 2011. Is some of this the result of the recession? Are these people who are just not included in unemployment statistics because they're not even looking for work?
You know, it's not really a recession story. If you look from 1996 through 2011, what you see is really what social scientists call a monotonic increase, meaning that there's a pretty steady increase in the number of people living under $2 per person per day. We do see a spike during the recession, but it is really not a recession story. And in fact, as sort of we draw on a number of sources of sort of big data to track this trend, and it shows no sign of abating. And what it suggests is that there's really something changing in the labor market at the very bottom that is causing this problem. So it's the transformation of low-wage work along with a dysfunctional TANF system that no longer catches people when they fall. The most common event preceding a fall into $2-a-day poverty is the loss of a low-wage job.
I'm assuming this isn't an inevitable situation, given that this is such a new phenomenon, relatively speaking. What is the solution? How do people get out of this? What needs to be done?
Well, I think we really need to pay attention to what people want. I'm so glad that I've really had the privilege to spend the last 20 years of my career in households like Ashley's and Ray's and Paul's and Jennifer's. What they want is a job. They find tremendous dignity in work. They think of themselves as workers, and that's why they refuse oftentimes to go on welfare even when they know about it. A lot of people don't know about it anymore, by the way. It's really sort of suffered its most profound death in the minds of the poor who don't even think about it as an option. They want to be workers, and so I really think we need to, what Luke and I recommend is a radical rethinking of how to expand work opportunity. The welfare reform bill is called the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act, and people have risen to the call. They're willing to be personally responsible. They want to work, but what we haven't done is we haven't expanded work opportunity. And if we're going to continue to go down the road of really recrafting our safety net around work, we have to really rethink how we can create robust work opportunity for every American who's willing to work.
All right, Catherine, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
William Julius Wilson, in his review, calls the book essential and a call to action. The book, again, is $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America by Catherine Eden and Luke Schaefer. John Williams joins us now, representing the voice of our readers and listeners. Hi, John.
Hey, Pamela.
So on the bookends page this week, we asked, is everyone a critic or are special qualifications needed? Who are critics anyway? You turn this over to our followers on Twitter as well.
Yes, Adam Kirsch and Charles McGrath talk about it in the paper. And on Twitter and Facebook, we asked people what they thought made for a good literary critic. And we got some pretty straightforward answers from people. Eva Stalker said that she wanted a voice and worldview of their own so that the criticism is a pleasure to read in itself. I've always felt that's really important. Our listeners definitely have a sense of humor. Mick Mitchell says the ability to read. So that lowers the bar quite a bit.
That eliminates quite a number of people.
It does. Nessa says honest critics make the best critics. The arbitrary reader said, I want to be informed, not patronized or intimidated. And there were a lot of people who said something along those lines, which is don't use it as a place to show off your own, you know, credentials, but address the thing that's being reviewed. Katie Abundanza says fair, opinionated, gives context and not too obsessed with their own prose. Dion Charlotte said, I believe a good critic chooses not to critique an entire literary genre along with the book he, she is reviewing.
That's, yeah.
And that happens quite a bit, I think.
The old platform review.
There's even a special name for it.
It's easier to talk about what people do wrong as critics than what they do right.
It is. And Sue Kitchenside says she wants someone to convey the essence of a book and the quality of its prose without revealing too much of the plot. And we get that a lot. People, a couple of times a year, people will say, oh, I got to that paragraph and it made me not want to read the book because I figured out what happened in the end.
Yes, we have to remain alert to potential spoiler alerts.
I should also mention here that in addition to on Twitter, where you can follow us at NY Times Books, we asked this question on our new Facebook page for books. And people can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/NYTBooks and get books coverage from our section and all around the paper.
Well, John, you're also a critic in addition to a podcast guest.
From time to time.
Yes. How do you answer this question?
I agree with a lot of the general guidelines that our listeners gave. I do think you should avoid plot spoilers. I think, in fact, you know, straight plot summaries in general are kind of boring and that reviews should aspire to more than that. I think in general, the highest bar, something you should aspire to even if you can't reach it, is to write something that in and of itself will be entertaining and insightful enough to be read, let's say, 30 or 40 years after the book is out. So it's not just a guide to what to read now, but it has lasting value, like the film reviews of Pauline Kael or the book reviews of one of my favorite writers, Wilfred Sheed, who wrote for The Times a lot several decades ago.
All right. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Pamela.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list?
Most of the action this week is on the fiction side of the hardcover lists, where there are five new titles. Starting down at number 15, a posthumous story collection by a writer named Lucia Berlin called A Manual for Cleaning Women. Listeners may remember that the reviewer of that collection for us, Ruth Franklin, was on the podcast recently.
It's always the case that a story collection by a relatively unknown dead person enters the bestseller list.
Oh, yeah. Totally familiar situation.
All right.
This is a collection that's gotten some attention. There was a profile of Lucia Berlin in the Daily Paper, and it was also reviewed by Dwight Garner in the Daily Arts section.
Everybody's wondering why they hadn't heard of her before.
That's right. Then at number 7, somebody that everybody has heard of, Christopher Moore, is back with a sequel to his book, A Dirty Job, called Secondhand Souls. At number 6, Philippa Gregory writes another Tudor novel. This one is The Taming of the Queen, about Henry VIII and his 6th wife, Catherine Parr. Then up at number 3, Louise Penny returns to the list with her 11th Armand Gamache novel called The Nature of the Beast. And finally, new at number 1, X Marks the Spot, Sue Grafton is back on the list with a book just called X, part of her Alphabet series.
All right. What do we have on nonfiction?
Just two new titles on the nonfiction side of things. Tracy Daugherty's biography of Joan Didion, The Last Love Song, makes its entrance on the hardcover nonfiction list at number 11. And then Steve Silberman, who was also on the podcast recently, has a history of autism called Neurotribes, and that's new at number 8.
All right, then. Thanks so much, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.